Good morning, everybody. Thank you. That was a beautiful introduction. I hope I can live up to that. Oh, man, y'all really got it going on here. My name is Gail, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I'm also very blessed. And I want to tell you that when I first came into the program, we went to a lot of speaker meetings, and I just wanted to be a speaker. They were so wise, and people would laugh, and they'd hug them afterwards. And besides the fact that I didn't have anything to share, I didn't know you had to do anything to get ready to do this. You know, that was my desire until I was asked to speak at a local meeting. And then I hadn't had that desire since then because it's real stressful to me. I want to introduce my husband. He's the drill sergeant they talked about last night. This is my husband. Stand up, please. He's my chauffeur, my friend, and my lover, and sometimes he's my partner in crime. You know, sometimes I get kind of long-winded, and the tape will be in the back, and he'll be doing like this, and I say, oh yeah, and Tom and I got married, and everything's fine, and you know, that's all I ever say, so I thought I'd kind of address that. And we married, both of us, in the program. And my husband's been a good example to me as when it comes to love and service. And so I was thinking, you know, like Tuesday night, he's sponsoring these two guys, and he has them scheduled back-to-back, and so we have new people coming in, and I'm so grateful for the program because I understand how important that is, and he understands how important it is for me to keep my Al-Anon commitments and to take time out of my life to sponsor the people I sponsor. And so I want to say that up front, how much I love this program, how much I appreciate Alcoholics Anonymous and what it gave us, and also what it's given to the people in my life that suffer from this disease that I love so much. In our meetings, we read the welcome, and then we have a statement of purpose, and the very last sentence of the statement of purpose is that we remind people that we keep the focus on us and not the alcoholic, and I'm going to try to do that. You know, I got up real early this morning, and I've been asking God to relieve me of the bondage itself, and I'm just believing he's going to do it. I'm just a little country girl, and there's been times in my life I didn't want to be a little country girl, but I'm on Medicare now, and I just don't think I'm going to get over it. But because of the program, you know, I've really come to appreciate where I came from, what I was given, and also just the fact that I believe that God gets us, you know, we come from wherever we're supposed to, and he gets us to where we're going. I had nice parents, lovely parents. When I hear people talk about some of the things that occurred in their childhood, it makes me that much more grateful. And you know, they weren't perfect, but none of us are, and we all make mistakes. So, you know, I'm just this little country girl, and I don't know much about anything, and it was expected of me to go to college, and that was very, very important to my parents, because neither of my parents graduated from high school, and So they had worked really hard and saved, and it was expected we go to college, and I did that. And I can tell you that I did not have a plan. I had living one day at a time down pat back then. You know, I was just kind of going along and enjoying life. And so I went off to college, and I did what was expected of me. You know, I studied real hard, and I knew this, you know, it was really important to my parents. And when I was a senior, I moved out in an apartment with some other girls, and there was a lot of students living in this apartment and complex, and I would see this guy walk by. And, you know, he had the right color hair, and he had a car. Hey. You know, that's how I pick my life partners. And whatever. And, you know, and I think probably in any college, you know, there's a lot of drinking and things. And I was pretty naive. And I think there was some other stuff going on, but I was too dumb to catch on to that. And I didn't drink too much, and I certainly wasn't going to take any drugs. You know, I was too square for that. So anyway, I kind of chased him until he caught me. I put myself in his path every chance I could get. And there were all kinds of signs. I mean, everybody's talked about it. It was so interesting to me that everybody that got up to the podium, with the exception of Mr. Fabulous, told my story, and that's a gift of the program, the gift of identification. So anyway, you know, it's the 60s, and I got pregnant, and we got married, and that's just kind of how we did it in the 60s. And I used to didn't like to tell that from the podium, but it's a fact. And so, you know, about 6 weeks into this deal, I thought, oh my God, my first hint, of course he was drinking all along, but it was more than a hint, it was like a wake-up call, that we were in our little house, and he was wasted, and he was at a party, and he was talking to people, and there wasn't anybody there but me and him. You know, after a while, you begin to wonder, are they really here, and I'm not, you know, is it me or him? I thought, man, there's just something really bad wrong. I mean, I've been around people who drank, and I've been around people who were drunk, but I'd never witnessed anything like that. And, you know, at first I had that idea, well, you know, if I'm just perfect and I be the perfect wife, you know, all I had to go on was what my mother did. And, you know, my mother was there every day when we got home from school, and she had supper on the stove, and we sat down as a family and ate, and she kept the house spotless, and she washed our clothes and ironed them and did all those things. And so I thought, you know, that was my first idea. Well, if I just be a good enough wife, you know, he'll just see that he needs to change. And while he was working, we were living in Missouri. It's the only time I've lived out of the state of Arkansas, and we lived there for 6 months. You know, while we were there, he got a DWI. Now, back in that little town that I was raised in, you know, we whispered about the people whose names were in the paper because they'd gotten a DWI. And he'd gotten a DWI, and he'd spent the night in jail. And I mean, there's just stuff going on that I don't have any experience with. And So I just decided, well, first of all, let me say, you know, when I did my inventory, I went back to that, and I would have told you that I could have gotten out, you know. I could have gotten out of that situation right then, and I said I didn't do it because I loved him, but the reason I didn't do it was that I was too proud to go home and tell my parents I'd made a big mistake. And my pride has put me in a lot of precarious positions. And so I made the decision that I passed judgment on him. I decided he obviously was lacking in moral character. And he lacked willpower. And I blamed whoever looked right for the blame for that. I blamed his parents and, you know, his friends and his ex-wife. Oh, he had an ex-wife, by the way. No kids. We didn't come with kids, but we had an ex-wife. I just appointed myself the person in charge. Now, and I did it like that. I didn't sit down or I didn't think about it, and I didn't pray about it, and I didn't talk to anybody about it. I'm just in charge. Because obviously, he just doesn't know how to take care of things. And so I did all those things. You know, I paid the bills, blah, 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 blah. Things just got worse. Now, there's a line in our welcome, and it says, our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. Since sometimes our literature is so simple that we miss things, and I would hear that, and what I would focus on was the second part. And I would think, God, that's an understatement. Irritable and unreasonable. You know, how about psychotic, you know, neurotic, suicidal. But the first part of that says, our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions. And the more and the longer I tried to force solutions, the more distorted my thinking became. I began to just, you know, fall into an abyss. I just would do some of the craziest things in the world and go into places that, you know, I didn't need to be in a biker bar. And, you know, he's going to come home now. I didn't know when I got him home, I never wanted him. I think, oh my God, what did I do that for? And then I do it again. Because he wasn't a pleasant drunk. And I hear people talk about that. I just can't relate to that because he was not a pleasant person. And so, we eventually moved back to Arkansas, and we both got a job, and we worked in a town called Benton, which is not too far from where we live now. And things just, you know, they just continued on that vein, and there were all those things, you know, that go on. There were DWIs and wrecks and some of those, just all kinds of things. Infidelity, very little violence in our home, but a lot of arguments and a lot of screaming, and it wasn't a nice place to be. And now we have a child, and I had a son, and I told myself that, well, I'm okay, you know, I pay the bills, I go to work. I keep the clothes clean. It's everything, you know, that I would go over in my mind that my mama would do. But I was consumed I was obsessed with the alcoholic. I've heard it said, you know, the alcoholic is obsessed with alcohol, and we are obsessed with the alcoholic, and I was obsessed, and I just, as that obsession grew, I just lost myself. My total focus was on him. And you know, I've thought about it since then, and I can't remember him asking me to do the things that I did. I was just always Johnny on the spot taking care of things, and I can't remember him ever asking me to do the things I did, to give up the things that I gave up. But I was very resentful. We were talking about it before the meeting about playing that victim role. Because, and for me, I can't say why other people do that, but when you're a victim, you don't have to be responsible. So you don't have to make a decision. I was too scared to move one way or the other. I thought about divorce. We've heard this before. I thought about homicide. I thought about that a lot. I really thought about suicide, and we say that and we laugh, but there were times that, you know, that was how I felt, you know, what my only way out was. And I want to tell you how I got here, because this was what was going on in our lives. My husband and I both worked in a school system, and this wasn't really a very big town at the time. And he worked at one school, and I worked at another school. And so I'm kind of like Teresa. I have like gray outs, and I just can't remember things. I can't remember the circumstances. But fortunately, it was part of the state hospital, because treatment centers weren't a big thing back then. So somehow he ended up in the alcoholic ward at the state hospital. And I can't tell you how that happened. And I was trying to think about what time period. We'd probably been married about 4 or 5 years, and I made up some stupid story. I know those people that I worked for thought I was crazier than he was, and you know, about where he was and what he was doing. And so he was going to come home on a Tuesday. And over the weekend, I got up on Saturday morning, and I can't really tell you that I prayed about this, but what I can tell you is I got up on that Saturday morning, and I walked down the hall and sit down in the rocking chair, and I had a clear thought. Now, I hadn't had a clear thought in a long time, and I thought, you know, my husband's an alcoholic, and I'm going to have to learn how to live with that. Now, people had said to me he was alcoholic, and man, it would fly all over me when people said he was alcoholic, because he was better than that. Now, I called him all kinds of names. But you don't need to be calling him an alcoholic. And the fact that I thought that I had anything to do with this was contrary to anything I'd believed before. And I have heard people talk about a window of grace. And I believe for me, this was a window of grace, and I think God was preparing me. And so he came home, and there was a group, an AA group there in Benton that took meetings into that facility, and he told me that he had met some people in AA. And he was going to go to AA, and there was a meeting there for the family. I think he said the wives, but anyway. And I went, the night came for us to go, and I went with no expectation. I was like a blank sheet of paper. And so I went in that room. I always love to reminisce about, you know, going to that meeting because it was in an old gas station. And they took the pumps out and everything, but they'd converted this gas station, and there was smoke hung about, you know, it's about eye level. And there was all these men in there, and they were laughing and talking. Nobody's listening. They're just all talking, slapping each other on the back, hugging people, God, I just loved it. I just loved it. And they took me back, and they showed me where the coffee was, and then they showed me where the Al-Anon room was. And I'm sure that this room that we met in was a utility closet. I mean, really, I'm sure that's what it was. It wasn't big enough to be a bedroom. It was just this little room, and all these chairs lined up around the wall, and people in there were old. They were like my age now. But I was in my 20s, so the closest person in age was probably around 40. And anyway, I don't, you know, we always worry about the newcomer and what do you say, the newcomer and blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't remember anything, so, you know, I don't ever worry about it. I think, oh, they're not going to remember this. Just smile at them and tell them you're glad they're there. Whatever. But what I do remember, I don't remember what people said, but I came away with the feeling that that people understood. They talked about things that I had experienced, and they talked about feelings that I'd had. And I'm telling you, I was so shut down. It was such a relief to know that this was happening in other people's homes and that they had found a solution. And I tell this story every time, and sometimes people go, but this little lady came up to me and she said, "Honey, you come back, it'll help your husband." Well, she just hooked me. I mean, really, I want to help my husband. So anyway, so I kept coming back, and there wasn't a lot of meetings back then, even like in Little Rock, which is one of our bigger towns. And so we would get in the car and we'd go to different meetings, and you'd have the meeting before the meeting and the meeting and the meeting and the meeting after the meeting, and it was just a growing time for me. And I listened, and I remember people talked about alcoholism being a disease, and I wasn't really buying into that, but I didn't want to tell them because I really liked these people, and I wanted to stay, but I didn't want to tell them I wasn't buying into that. And how I came to believe that alcoholism is a disease is by going to open AA meetings. I was so resentful toward my husband that I didn't believe anything he said, but I came to believe when I heard so many people describe the things that were going on in our home, and I began to believe that was a disease. And I began to believe that my life could get better. I got a sponsor. And actually, I'm not going to tell you my first sponsor story because I'll probably cry and I'll have mascara all over my face and whatever. So I got this sponsor, and so we began to work the steps. And when we got to the steps that mentioned God, I I was really, really uncomfortable. There's a line in one of our books that says, God is not a terrorist. And you know, I'm a school teacher, so I like to look up words. So I looked up the word terrorist. And a terrorist is somebody who controls by fear. And I really did look at God as a terrorist. I wouldn't have used that word, but I looked at God as a being who was fickle, who would give you candy on one day and zap you the next day. You know, it wasn't anything that I could trust in. And so finally, you know, she was pretty smart, and she picked up on this stuff, and she said, this is what I want you to do, and I want you to do it every day. I want you to get on your knees in the morning, and I want you to ask God to help you, and I want you to get on your knees at night, and I want you to thank him. And I don't know why I did that, because she told me to. Wasn't anybody watching me, but I did it because she told me to. And I felt like my prayers went to the ceiling and they just fell on the floor. And I'd get up off my knees and I'd just think, this is the stupidest thing. And I kept doing it. And that's all I did. That's the only prayers I said. And it was less than a month. And my feelings began to change. This program amazes me because it's just a wonder to me. It's a mystery. So anyway, so we're on that little path, and so I continue to do that. You know, if I get in trouble today, I go back and do that. It's just such a simple thing. This is such a simple program. Oh, jeez. Anyway. So, you know, I kind of did this God thing as an experiment. So I started trying to turn little things over to God and see what would happen. I was just going to see what will happen. And you know, things, when you get yourself out of the way, what's supposed to happen happens. And so when I was turning these little things over to God, I wasn't in control anymore, and she'd also told me to keep my mouth shut. I said, you know, don't tell him what to do. Don't ask questions. He has a God of his own. He has a sponsor. Turn him over to his sponsor. And so anyway, I'm kind of doing my little experiment, and things are, you know, they're going pretty good, and we're not fussing, we're not fighting. He's going to meetings, I'm going to my meetings, sometimes we're going to meetings together. We had to learn how to talk to each other. One of my assignments was that I was supposed to say something nice to my husband every day, and the first day that I was supposed to do that, I just thought all day long. I was at work and I was thinking, oh my God, now what am I going to say? What am I going to say? And so the only thing I could come up with was that he had pretty green eyes. And so he comes home and, you know, I'm like waiting on him to tell him he has pretty green eyes. He looked at me like I was from another planet. He's like, what? You know, but it was easier the next day. And it got easier and easier and easier. So I'm doing my little God experiment. And school had just started. And I taught math. And I had we call them different things now. I don't know what they call them now. But I had what was called an accelerated class, which means the kids are smart. And I had a boy in that class, big old boy. And I was not as fluffy as I am now. I was much smaller. And he probably made two of me. And his reputation had preceded him. And I'd been told that he was trouble. But, you know, things were going along pretty good. And one day he got kind of smart with me. And you know, my mode of operation is if you get in my face, then I get in your face. And it doesn't matter to me if I have to get on a stepladder to do it. And 'cause you need to know I'm in charge. You know, this is my classroom and I am in charge. And you're going to do what I say. That was my attitude. And that day, for whatever reason, probably because I got on my knees that morning and asked God to help me, I just kind of let it pass. But I thought, I need to address this. And so I decided to address it at the end of class. And then I did something foreign for me. I asked God to give me the words to say. And so class is over and he comes by my desk. And I say, this is what comes out of my mouth. I have no thought of this ahead of time. This is what comes out of my mouth. Michael, you know, you're the smartest kid in this class. And it would really help me out a lot if you would treat me with respect. And he grunted at me. Oh. And I thought, oh, God. What is wrong with me? This is, Lord have mercy. And so, of course, y'all know what happened. I had, you know, maybe 25 kids. And I can tell you this was the best class I ever taught. Michael became exactly what I said. You know, maybe he needed to hear that. I don't know. Maybe I needed to say it. But as the year progressed, I was just awed. And you know, I began to believe I could accept that God would do for me what I could not do for myself. Let me get off of this. Anyway. One of the nice things about that was that I met Michael's mother at parent-teacher conference, and she came into my room kind of looking like she wished she wasn't there, like somebody might hit her. And so I began to gush over Michael and what a good student he was. And she said, you know, I never hear that. Most of the time, I don't even come to parent-teacher conferences. I was just so grateful to be able to share that with her. Well, you know, things rock on. I have a long story. I've been here a long time. Terry will probably be back there going. So, my husband, our marriage ended. And I'm going to tell you what it looked like from the outside, but I've come to believe it was something else. He lost a job. He began to drink again. He stayed sober for a year. He began to drink again. He got a job on the... anyway, we moved halfway in between where he had a job and we were both driving. And we moved to Little Rock and we were living in an apartment and we hadn't been there long at all. And he moved out with this other woman. And I was just in shock. I was in shock. And you know, I just took a nosedive. Now, I have a district office by now. I'm involved in service and I have a district office and I'm just Looney Tunes. I was a treasurer, for God's sake. I hope I don't owe him any money, but, you know. I think the statute of limitations run out. God. It was just pitiful. And this is what this is how I felt. Because I'm in that room, and, you know, I'd started going to this group in Little Rock called the 120 and a half group. We used to be famous, you know. Oldest group west of the Mississippi, and there was two past delegates and a current delegate, and I'm telling you, they meant business in that room. We study the traditions. I mean, it was good, strong Al-Anon. And I feel like I failed, you know. I failed Al-Anon. Now, there used to be an old lady in there. God love her, I shouldn't say that. There used to be a lovely old lady there. And she'd say, "Well, we may not save your marriage, but we'll save your sanity." And I don't like hearing that, so I just dismissed that. That's not going to happen to me. And I just felt like I'd failed Al-Anon, and I failed in life, and I did not want to be a divorced woman, and I was determined I wasn't going to be a divorced woman, and so, you know, I just didn't file for divorce. Well, I'm not a divorced woman. I mean, he may be living over there with somebody else, but I'm not divorced. Oh, so anyway. I had already, you know, worked through my men's step. My sponsor suggested we may need to go back and start over, so we did that. And I did a couple of four steps, and I was really angry, and I really talked ugly about him, and I talked ugly to him, and I just did all kinds of things, and finally, you know, it was kind of like, and I think Teresa talked about it, you know, I was just a mess, and this had been going on for about 18 months, you know. I mean, I'm pretty dedicated to this not being a divorced woman, and I don't know what had happened, but it's identified. I mean, I was just bawling and squalling, and I said, "Okay, God, you know, if you want me to be a divorced woman, well, I'm just willing, it's whatever." But I wasn't, I didn't do that humbly, you know. I was pretty mad the whole 18 months. And I was living in the worst place in Little Rock, and I got up that next morning, and it's kind of like, it was just over. And I don't know how that happens, you know. I just gave up. And so I looked out, and this is what I see when I look out the window where I'm living. There's a dumpster right outside my window. And there's trash on the parking lot. And I'm living in a scary part of town. Back then they had Southwest Little Rock Rapist was on the loose. And I mean, I had chairs up next to the door and things covering the windows and everything. And somebody come by, did a drive-by shooting and shot out my back windshield. So I got, you know, this plastic stuff. I got up and I looked out the window and I thought, you know, I don't have to live like this anymore. And it was just over. And I filed for divorce, so I was a divorced woman. I remarried. A couple of years later, maybe a little bit longer, I remarried. And a gentleman in the program, I continued to go to Al-Anon. It doesn't surprise me that I married somebody in the program. We speak the same language. And, you know, all this time I have this child that I'm dragging through all this nonsense. And I was involved in service, and I stood for an area office, and I didn't get an area office. And somebody who didn't know what they were talking about said to me, "Well, you're through. You know, you can't hold another office." And I believed him. I didn't question that. I don't know why. I had my head in the sand, I guess. Anyway, so you know, I continue to go to Al-Anon. I have always gone to Al-Anon. I've gone to Al-Anon if I'm happy, if I'm sad, if I'm, you know, I just feel at home there. And so I was married to this gentleman, and we were married for 20 years. And I remember trying to think of what year it was, 1999. I came in the program in 1974. One of the services that has been vital to my recovery is sponsorship. And I've loved to sponsor people, and I kind of grab them up. If they just kind of hint that they need a sponsor, I say, oh, I'll sponsor you. So I sponsor in people and learn a lot of things from the people I sponsor. I sponsor some of the most amazing women. It just blows me away. So anyway, first day of school, my husband been to the doctor. He had a little problem, thought he'd go to the doctor, and I called him and I said, what'd the doctor say? And he said, the doctor says I have lung cancer. And I was like, oh, wow. And so when I get home, I said, I can't believe you told me that on the phone. And he said, well, what'd you call me for? Now, we went to the doctor, and he gave us all this stuff. You know, and I was going to be a good Al-Anon. I was, and I was just sitting there, and I was listening and everything. And so the doctor says, we can do chemo today, or we can wait till Monday and start. And my husband says, well, I wanted to play golf tomorrow. And I went, what? I said, are you crazy? And then the doctor volunteered to leave the room. And so I got my way that day. So anyway. You know, I don't know how I would have made it through that if I hadn't been in Al-Anon, because I hadn't had that experience. But I know that Al-Anon, this program, the God of My Understanding, was my strength. And I know that his program was his strength, too. He lived about as they said, about 18 months, and that's about how long he lived. I had lots of help. Anytime, you know, we weren't just bombarded by people, but anytime we had a need, it was met. Somebody showed up, and everything that we needed. I had taken out a cancer policy some years before that, and it paid for everything, and you know, we just really didn't have very, very many worries. I have to tell you that my husband took radiation and chemo, and he played golf for 6 months. He did that. I was amazed. So during that time, my dad had gotten sick too, and I tried to be all things to all people, tell you the truth. And I tried to help my mother with my dad, and I tried to be of help and support to my husband. And then I was trying to work too. Oh, we're just so fabulous, aren't we? Oh, man. If I had it to do over, I think I'd do it a little bit different. But anyway, my dad died, and a couple of weeks later, my husband died, and it was in May, and so school was about over. And, you know, what I know now is that I don't know how to grieve. And I hit the ground running. Because, you know, if you stop long enough, you have to do that. You have to grieve. And so I hit the ground running, and we buried my husband on Thursday, and on Monday morning I was back at work. I don't think that's an awful thing, but I don't think it was a very wise thing to do. And I sold my house in Little Rock that summer and moved back to where I was working, and I played golf. By now I'm playing golf too, and I just played golf obsessively. There were some people in the other program in AA, and I'd been playing golf with them for a long time, and they were all guys, you know, and they just let me play golf with them. And, you know, if you get tired enough, you just go home and fall in the bed, and you don't have to think about those things. So that's kind of how I did it. My husband had been dead 2-3 years, and, you know, and I was just running with Al-Anon gals, and I was really kind of enjoying myself, and the people at work were very kind to me, and everybody made sure that I had places to go. And I said one time, you know, I went to birthday parties for people I didn't even know. You know, I got invitations. You wouldn't believe it. They were so wonderful. And so I went somewhere. One of those deals, really, kind of, I went somewhere I probably would never went, because there was some people there in AA and Al-Anon that were going to be there, and I wanted to see them, so I went, and that's where I met Tom. And I'll just tell it, and then you can get on to me later. Anyway, I have to tell you also that I knew he was in the program because I had seen him at conferences, and I had admired him from afar. And you know, I always say, well, you know, I may be married, but I'm not blind. And so if I admire my neighbor's flowers, I'm not going to go over there and dig it up. I'm just going to admire it, see? So I had admired him from afar because he was married back then. So anyway, so he's there with his friends from AA, and I'm there, and we meet. And so that's kind of how we got together. And it's a lot of fun dating in AA, because then all my friends, and, you know, I had AA friends and Al-Anon friends in this little town in Benton, and they're just all concerned. Oh, my God. They're all concerned. I'm too stupid to be concerned. I'm not concerned. I'm in love. See? And he's in the program, so it's okay. And so anyway, we got married. We did it like the alcoholic way, you know. We got married 6 months later. At least we waited 6 months. Hey, you know. And so he moved to Benton. He had a job where, you know, he could work from anywhere. And I had my life planned, see, about, I know when I'm going to retire. I know where I'm going to live. I know how I'm going to live my life. And all that changed. And I had bought this little house in Benton. It was real cute. It's blue, and it had pink wallpaper. No. Ruffles on the pillows. And so, besides the fact that it was girly, it wasn't big enough for the two of us. So, it was a nice house for a single person. And so, anyway, we started looking around for another house, and I was going to retire in a couple of years, and so we moved to this place called Hot Springs Village, which is a retirement community, and it's on the edge of the Ozark Mountains. It's really, really beautiful there. And you know, where I grew up, it was just dirt. It's farming community, and way off over there you might see a tree that somebody left on a fence row. But I mean, everything's flat, and so we move over, it's hilly, and they have deer, and you can see deer in your yard, and it's just this lovely place. And so we move over there, and I worked for another year, and I didn't enjoy the drive, and so I retired. And 6 months after I retired, I went to stay with my mother, because my mother had Alzheimer's. And I didn't realize it because I'd been working and I wasn't paying attention. And my mother had some other, she was diabetic, she had lupus, and she wasn't taking her medicine. She thought she was taking her medicine, but she wasn't. And so we kind of did that deal. I have a sister. So my sister was still working, and we're trying to take care of her. And I finally had to, my mother had a business, a farm. I had to take her to court and get guardianship. And you know, I can tell you this, and it doesn't take very long. Just about ripped my heart out. Okay. I'll get over it in a minute. So finally, you know, I mean, the last 6 months we were, thank you, dear. Or the last 6 weeks, I was there 24/7. And I have to tell you that my husband was very supportive. And bear in mind, we hadn't been married but a couple of years. And, you know, I just went off and stayed basically for 6 months. And I brought her home and with me. And that, and you know, if you have any experience with that disease, then you know that... every time you move them, they get worse. It's basically what happens. But you know, one of the things that helped me a lot is I knew my mother was doing the very best she can because you taught me that in this program, that people do the best that they can with what they know at the time. And she was doing the very best she could at the time. And so eventually, my sister worked some magic, and I don't really want to know how she did it, because I just don't want to know. But all of a sudden, there's, you know, we're looking for Alzheimer's units, and all of a sudden she calls me and she says, you know, at such and such place, they have a room, blah, 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 blah. She told me what we had to do, and we did it. Now, my mother, years ago, had told me, she had two sisters who suffered from the same disease, and she made me promise her that if she ever got in that shape, that I would put her in a nursing home, because she didn't want to hurt herself or hurt other people. That should have been some comfort to me, but it wasn't. And I spent, I don't know how much time, beating myself up because I did not meet my expectations of what a daughter should do. I felt like I should be able to take care of her, and I felt like I should have been able to keep her at my home, and I just couldn't. And I would lay down at night, and I mean, I'd just go, ooh, you know, I'd think about it, and I'd just do that. I just couldn't get over it. And I talked to my sponsor. And, you know, they tell you reasonable things, but they're not talking to a reasonable person. You know, I knew it made sense. So I wonder how much time I have. Probably not enough. Anyway, you know, I want to tell you how all this ends. Or Terry will be back there going like this. Back last year, first of the year, actually, my husband quit smoking. I was supposed to go to the delegates meeting in March, and about a week before that, he just has this big meltdown at me. And I'm like, oh my God. And, you know, we're supposed to say, I'm sorry you feel that way. Oh, yes. Well, I was just speechless. I mean, it just came out of left field. And of course, you know, he knows what to do. And he leaves and he goes to his sponsor's house. And my default position is I need to stay here and make this right. But that's not what I did. I knew I had this trip planned. I made the decision to go on and do that. And I did that, and I went off with these three crazy women. I met Sylvia there. We shopped, we ate. We shopped, and then we ate. And we ate our way to Kansas. We ate our way back. And you know, in the meantime, Tom and I talked on the phone, and so I knew he wasn't, like, going to be gone when I got home, which was kind of my fear. And, you know, I always blow things way out of proportion, and I can take that and run it to the end of the line, and it's never anything good. It's always the worst-case scenario. That's one of my defects of character that I have to watch for. And so this is what happens. I get home on Monday. On Tuesday, I go to a meeting. There's this little lady. She's been coming to our meeting, and she's talking, and she said, well, I know I need to get a sponsor. And I said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. And she said, well, I know you're busy. And I said, I'm not that busy. I'll be your sponsor. And so I started sponsoring her. I started working with her. And I may not have helped her at all, but I mean, she helped me tremendously. Because when I sponsor people, I go through the steps. And so I started going through the steps. And I do kind of an expanded form of what it says in the big book. And so we do the columns. And you know, I'm not talking about my mama. I'm not even... You know, it's like a pain that I've learned to live with. And so, you know, we're doing our resentments and we're talking about all that and everything. And I'm at a meeting on Wednesday night, and I don't even remember what the program was on, but I'm going to read to you what it says. And there's no way for me to tell you how, you know, what a difference it's made for me. But one of the things that I've started doing is praying when I go to a meeting is asking God to open my mind and open my heart to hear what other people have to say. So they read this in the meeting, and it says, regrets are vain. They interfere with the good I could do today, the making of the better person I want to be tomorrow. Condemning ourselves for mistakes we have made is just as bad as condemning others for theirs. We are not equipped to make judgments, not even of ourselves. In that last sentence, I thought, oh my God, you know, I did just what I did. Almost 40 years prior, I looked at that, I passed judgment on it, and then I treated that as if it was reality. And I had judged myself, I had found myself lacking, and I was carrying that guilt around with me. And so every morning, I read this. And I don't have those memories anymore, and I'm not carrying that guilt around. Not to say I couldn't pick it up again, but but today I'm free of that. I have no way of knowing if I did the right thing or not. But I know that my God is the only one with the wisdom to judge me And he's also a forgiving God. And I feel forgiven. Well, anyway, so, you know, we're working on that. It's a funny thing happened with that. I just wanted to tell you. So we do our little resentment thing, and she does her fifth step, and I say, there's always something you've left out. So you be sure and call me. And so I see her at the meeting, and I said, did you think anything you left out? No, didn't think anything I left out. Well, I thought of two things. Now, she hadn't thought any yet, but I thought, you know, last time I did this, I had these two people on my resentment list, and they're still here. And so, you know, God works in mysterious ways. You know, for a long time, my first husband that brought me to this program got killed in a car wreck. He was 60 years old, too young to die. He was living on the street in a tent. Never been able to get this program. When that happened, my son came home, and I went with him. We cleaned out the truck, and we did the, you know, I helped him with the funeral and everything. And, you know, this thought came to me that if I hadn't been in this program, I wouldn't have been able to keep my mouth shut. And it wasn't even a chore to keep my mouth shut. God, you know, this program and the God in this program had removed all of that stuff from me. And I realized, you know, that we were just sick people doing what sick people do. And you know, if we can't let go of that, we'll never get well. And so I was there for my son. I was able to be kind to the family. I was glad to see them. And I was sad for him that he never was able to enjoy any sort of or any length of sobriety. And I was sad for my son because his disease had taken him away so early. You know, all weekend long, I've tried to come up with something to close. And I found it this morning when I read my daily reading. And it's not actually the 21st. It was on the previous page. Oh, you know, if I forgot to tell you, you know, as I worked through these steps and as Tom worked with his sponsor, you know, we kind of got through our little deal and I think quit smoking had a lot to do with myself. and I love him very much. I appreciate everything that he does for me and how supportive he's been to me. This is on July the 20th, and it says, change is inevitable. We can depend on that. When we become willing to accept change, we make room for a loving God. By letting go of our efforts to influence the future, we become freer to experience the present, to feel all our feelings while they're happening, and to more fully enjoy those precious moments of joy with which we are blessed. Thank you very much.